Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wes Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscribe today at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 143, P.G. Woodhouse and Sherlock Holmes.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Oh, I say, pip, pip, and all that. This is I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Walder.
You mean you're not Jeeves? You're not my man?
Very good, sir. If it amuses you to think of me in that fashion, who am I to get in your way?
Well, you are a gentleman's gentleman. Mr. Walder.
That's what I like. That's a wonderful. Yeah. That's a wonderful attribution. Thank you very much.
I always like that phrase, a gentleman's gentleman. And of course, Jeeves and Wooster is probably the most approachable or understood or certainly familiar iteration of P.G. Woodhouse's works. And I mean, who can't relate to a daft Englishman who is completely idle? And his much smarter than life valet, Jeeves. I mean, haven't we all been there?
Yes, you know, the sad part is that the checks that I'm supposed to be receiving from my ancient and inherited family trust haven't been coming lately. In fact, haven't been coming at all. And that's what really needs to be addressed.
Well, I mean, you think about the life that Bertie Wooster had. Simply being someone who, you know, was living off of a trust fund, essentially. And there were so many like him at the Drones Club. And this is partially where we get the phrase, the idle rich, from. Do you think you'd get bored if you were in such a situation?
Oh, no. No.
I mean, that's
a
world
too many interests.
Towards.
There are too many things to do. And I just like to be busy. I like to...
Yeah. Well, you have something in between your ears, so that's the difference.
that's this attractive deerstalker hat.
You look good. You look good.
Yeah. My deerstalker headphones.
Well, since we've spoken last, one bit of Sherlockian news we just wanted to share, and that is that the manuscript for The Dancing Men has been sold at auction. We wrote this up on the website. You can check it out at ihearofsherlock.com. And it was sold at auction for $250, hammer price, then plus the, 25% buyer's premium on top of that. So it went for a cool $312,500 in total. I'm sad to say that we haven't reached that level here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere yet. We have not managed to get our PayPal and Patreon fundees to be able to get us to that bidding level. So sadly, it will not be going on the roadshow that we had hoped that it would, should we have been lucky enough to win.
No, but folks, this is a great reason why right now, or at least in the next few minutes, you should go over to PayPal and Patreon and click several times, put in big numbers, many zeros, because soon we could be bringing that kind of a manuscript to you to look at it a far distance from the safety of a pressurized glass enclosed case. And before we get back into our IHO's luxury tour bus to go to another city, we could give you an autograph. And these kinds of – this sort of valuable experience. You know, today it's most important to invest in experiences, not things. So forget about rent and food and donate to IHearOfSherlock.com.
That's good. Well, I like the idea of many zeros. That's the least you can do for the two zeros that you're hearing here in your earbuds. So we appreciate it. Well, speaking of Benjamins – we hope you would spend a few of those with our friends at Wessex Press.
Here in the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, we celebrated St. George's Day on April 23rd. He delivered our greatest victories. Even though he plundered the pagan temples in a rare burst of bad judgment, he remains an inspiration for us all. Just like Chris Redmond, whose A Quick Succession of Subjects, Lectures and Speeches on Sherlock Holmes, is available right now from our WessexPress.com. These discourses on World War I, constitutional law, and the religious and spiritual themes in the cases of Sherlock Holmes is only $19.95. I envy the droning idle bee, seeking his nectar sweet, in that palace of light, suspended there by his hooked, piratical feet. Enrich the sun-drenched month of May with the pleasure only a book from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
Well, if you enjoyed that, there's probably any number of things that you would enjoy in the realm of Sherlock Holmes and ancient lands. They're all over the place. You can find publications like that really all over the internet, places to buy them, but we hope you'll continue to lay waste to our friends at WessexPress.com. Well, if you'd like to get in touch with us, there are a variety of ways to do that. Certainly on our show website, IHearOfSherlock.com. If you're looking for the show notes for this particular episode, you can go to ihos.co/ihos143, all lowercase, ihos.co/ihos143. That'll get you to everything related to this episode, including a link to buy the book, which we're interviewing these three fine people about. We're I Hear of Sherlock on all of the social webs, and God help you if you can pick up that phone, if you can punch those little numbers or tap your fingers against those little numbers that you see and actually make a physical phone call to us, we might put your comment on the air. It's a challenge. It's a challenge for you. It's a challenge for us. Take us up on it. And one thing to note, we have changed the rules once again for the better for our canonical couplets quiz, which you'll hear later in the show. Stay tuned on exactly what that means, and how it affects you. Well, we are pleased in this episode to be joined not by one, not by two, but by three individuals. And the good news is you have heard two of them here previously. The first one, Curtis Armstrong, of course, joined us for episode 125, Revenge of the Sherlockian Nerd. And Curtis is well-versed in a variety of subjects. If you ever run into Curtis at an event, well, you can talk to him certainly about Sherlock Holmes, but you can also talk to him about Harry Nilsson. You can talk to him about Washington Irving. And, of course, you can talk with him about P.G. Wodehouse. Curtis had his origins here in Detroit, where I'm broadcasting from, but there he met with our second guest, Elliot Milstein, and then the two of them traveled the world of Jeeves and Wooster and P.G. Wodehouse more widely together. So welcome to Curtis, and of course welcome to Elliot, who says, according to his biography, that he was born on October 15th, 1881 in a log cabin in Chillicothe, Ohio, to a gentleman farmer and fishwife. Well, if that doesn't sound like the beginning of a Wodehouse novel, I don't know what was. Of course, Elliot has been trying to interest people in Wodehouse for more than 40 years. And, of course, that led to him joining the Wodehouse Society in 1989, where he became vice president in 1993, and then president in 95. And not only that, because he's a man of many countries, Elliot joined the P.G. Wodehouse Society, the Dutch P.G. Wodehouse Society, and the P.G. Wodehouse Society in the U.K. So an international man of mystery. He's given 7 talks at Wodehouse conventions and threatens to continue doing so until someone listens to him. Well, hopefully you all are tuned in here and willing to listen to Elliot. And then finally, our third guest is Ashley Polasek, a member of the Baker Street Babes. She's joined us here on episode 70 when we did that rousing quiz show. You might go back and check that out. Ashley, in her role for A Plum Assignment, has acted as editor, bringing the stories of Curtis and Elliot together. And, of course, Ashley is very interesting because she actually has her PhD in comparative Sherlockian studies. And we bring the three of them together to talk about this new book, A Plum Assignment, Discourses on P.G. Wodehouse and His World. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. See, it's that easy.
Thank you.
I have jumped.
We've jumped right in. Gentlemen and lady.
My apologies, gentlemen and lady. We have a quintet this time around. There are 5 of us here on the line. So things may get a little discombobulated, but we will do our best to recombobulate them for our fine listeners. Curtis, Elliot, Ashley, welcome.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, there is so much to cover here with Wodehouse because, as we know, Wodehouse was quite the prolific author. And obviously, we want to cover the intersection of our interests in Sherlock Holmes and P.G. Wodehouse. So why don't we start where we usually begin and ask people about their first associations? And you can choose, because we're talking about 2 different subjects here, your first meeting with Sherlock Holmes or P.G. Wodehouse. And why don't we start with the lady?
Well, my first meeting actually is, it overlaps with them, believe it or not. My introduction to Sherlock Holmes came when I was studying abroad in Scotland when I was an undergraduate. And I started dating an English fellow who we decided early on that the length of our relationship would be however long I was in Scotland, which was some 5 months or so. And in order to get to know each other faster, we exchanged book lists because that's what book nerds do. And he assigned me Sherlock Holmes and I assigned him P.G. Wodehouse. So I had encountered Wodehouse earlier when I was in high school, and so they're overlapping. They have all those fond memories associated with that early romance in my life, and Sherlock Holmes in Scotland, and him learning of P.G. Wodehouse and trying to have conversations while he was trying to incorporate a much larger oeuvre than the one he'd assigned me. But it was a lovely experience.
Well, that's doubly interesting because you say it was an Englishman you met in Scotland. Was he also of Irish descent?
not to my knowledge. So who knows? He was very mysterious.
Well, I want to know what you started him on. I mean, book-wise, obviously.
That's a story for the outtakes. No, we... there was a little used bookshop that was just around the corner from his flat, and he grabbed the first Woodhouse that was there, and I grabbed the first Sherlock Holmes that was there. And I, quite frankly, I still have the edition of Sherlock Holmes that I bought there for £3, all the complete short stories. Huh. I have no idea what Woodhouse he grabbed. I can't remember.
God, it could have been Dr. Sally.
It could have been. It could have been. Except that he continued to love Woodhouse, so it was probably...
Well, it wasn't Dr. Sally.
It wasn't Dr. Sally.
Oh. Okay, Elliot, how about you?
Well, I'm sort of the outlier here because I'm not actually a Sherlockian per se.
Oh.
Or actually, I'm not a Sherlockian at all. I my first Woodhouse...
Have you heard of Sherlock Holmes, Elliot? okay.
Vaguely.
Okay.
My first Woodhouse, the story of our first Woodhouse is in the book. Curtis tells his and I tell mine. My father read a lot of Woodhouse and had a lot of Woodhouse, so he started by trying to foist it onto me when I was too young, and then I came to him all by myself by roaming through my dad's library and picking up a book and going at that, and I was 17 at the time. Sherlock Holmes came as a result of Curtis. His obsession, he didn't actually tell me I had to read Sherlock Holmes, but he kind of made it clear that if the friendship was to continue and I was to understand what it was he was talking about, I really kind of had to. So sometime, maybe my first year of college or early, somewhere around there, I just read the entire canon straight through. And my impression basically was that they were very enjoyable, and I liked them. Some of them were really great, but I still couldn't understand why Curtis was doing what he was doing with regard to it. So, and that was the end of me and Sherlock Holmes until a number of years ago, and I decided that I would do it again and read the canon straight through again, and I have to say, I think I enjoyed it more the second time and really appreciated it more. But I had read a lot more and seen the movies and the TV show and so on and so forth, so I came to it with a different attitude. So but I still could not call myself, I'm sorry to say, a Sherlockian.
That's okay. We accept all types here. We are open.
Nobody's perfect, Elliot.
But I'm sensing a theme, Elliot. It takes you two times before these things stick.
Yeah, that's generally true of everything. Actually, two or three times, nothing really happens to me right off the bat.
Now, how young?
I'm too thick.
So you said you really got into Woodhouse when you were 17. How old were you when you first started to creep into your father's library to check out Plum?
Well, I mean, I've always crept into my father's library, but usually it was looking for other things. I was about 11, I think 11 or 12, when he first handed me Leave It to Smith to read, and it just made no sense to me, and I had no interest in it. And then a few years after that, I believe I was around 15, he gave me a Jeeves to read. And same thing, just not interested, didn't speak to me at all. And then I always remember, I mean, I can actually close my eyes and remember climbing up, because the Woodhouse shelf was rather high up in the library, and I had to climb up onto a table to reach it, and I just saw the title, Service with a Smile, and I thought, well, that's kind of a pleasant-sounding title, and I took it down, and that was it. From then on, I was hooked.
And over to you, Curtis. I think we did cover this
when we did the previous show. But basically, very quickly, it was with Sherlock Holmes. It was my father. It was basically the same story, only Sherlock Holmes. My father I was about 10. And he felt that it was something I would enjoy. I was reading a lot of Poe and Verne and Kipling and things like that, Mark Twain, and he passed that along to me, and it was actually The Adventure of the Five Orange Peps. And I will, it's another one of those very vivid recollections. I remember the feel of the fabric of the chair that I was sitting in Switzerland. We were living in Switzerland then. And everything about that moment as I opened that story. And then I went on to Hound of the Baskervilles from there. Because I there were so many stories, I wasn't sure where I should go. And he'd recommended Five Orange Pips for some reason. I don't know why. And so he then said, well, Hound of the Baskervilles. So I went to that. And then I just went to the beginning and started over. And I've been rereading Sherlock Holmes basically ever since. So that was my introduction to Holmes. With Woodhouse, it was also something which is in the book, which was at the same time in Switzerland. A friend of mine gave me a copy, lent me a copy of Very Good Jeeve, and I fell in love with it at once. And I started going down, because I had no other Woodhouse, I would go down periodically to the English bookstore in Geneva, and they had the Penguins there, which were new at the time. And I started buying up all of the Jeeves that I could find. And then I was out. And all that was left was a P.G. Woodhouse book called Pigs Have Wings. And at that point, I didn't realize that Woodhouse wrote different sagas. And I snatched it up and took it home, and it's a Blandings Castle book. And I just thought, where is Bertie? Where is the voice? Where are the characters? And it was bitterly disappointing that he had written something that didn't have Jeeves and Bertie in it. And it was not until I came back to the States, and Elliot was a big part of this when we met. He, at that point, had sort of been someone who didn't have much time for Jeeves and Wooster, and I hadn't had much time for Blandings, and so we sort of coaxed each other into each other's favorite saga, and that was where it went from there. I mean, it's just the way that friends, you know, can influence their development when it comes to books is one of the things that I find so interesting. And it certainly happened with us. I've seen it happen with my daughter and her friends, that bookish kids can really influence their friends and change things for them. And I think it took a while for me to realize it was so hard in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. to find Woodhouse books. It was kind of a dark age for that sort of thing. They weren't published here. There were copyright issues and things. So the discovery of all of those books, over 90 books, took a long time for us in the U.S.
Yeah.
And
well, we were lucky in that we lived in Detroit, and my father used to actually go into Windsor to buy books and
yeah.
bring them over. So
Windsor, Ontario.
That's why we had as many as we did.
Yeah.
And you guys have the opposite experience with your parents that I do. Every time I brought home a new book, my mother would say, "Another book? You've got a book."
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't know how I would handle that. I was very lucky that way.
Yeah.
Both of us were.
Well,
a lot of books in the home.
You mentioned Curtis, and I think this is a really particular fine point to rest on here, that that having bookish friends can make a difference. And when we read the canon, it becomes, and maybe not on our first pass, but maybe on our second or third, it becomes very apparent, as Christopher Morley said, that it is a textbook of friendship. These
yes.
two men, these colleagues and friends, who over the course of many decades appreciated each other for their strengths and their foibles as well. And as I was reading A Plum Assignment, it struck me that this is a book about friendship, you know, between Elliot and Curtis. And Ashley, I wonder how you as an editor approach that, because there's obviously there are papers in here that were shared at various Woodhousian events. But approaching this wonderful friendship, which again has blossomed over decades, how did you as an editor approach this with regard to the material there and the other material that needed to be kind of padded around it, shall we say?
Well, I'll tell you, when I got the manuscript, Curtis and Elliot didn't know that the book was about them. What they presented me, they had come up with the conceit of introducing each other's articles, but the book was organized around the articles. And when it came to me and I read through it, and I was reading these kind of interstitial pieces when it was originally set out, all of those little introductions were embedded inside the articles. So it was organized based on the articles. And when I read it, I went, The narrative is not the articles. The articles are these wonderful deep dives. And if you're a Woodhouse aficionado, there's so much rich material in there, and they're wonderfully witty in the way they're written. But the narrative of the book is actually in those interstitial pieces. And so I actually tore the whole, I printed out the first page of each introduction and each article, and I pasted them all over a giant whiteboard at work, and I reorganized and reordered everything. And the very first email I sent, this was Elliot's first introduction to me, because Curtis brought me in, and Elliot had never met me. We'd never had a conversation. And I sent this enormous email explaining why I thought this thing should be organized in a different way. And if they just trust me, I promise this is the story. Just stick with me. And to their credit, they let me just kind of get in and mess around with it. And we turned those pieces into their own story. So we added in the kind of idea of them being letters back and forth, so that readers get this sense of being part of their correspondence, and you watch their friendship develop over the course of those pieces. And it's fun. So you get to be part of that bookish friendship that I think a lot of us really treasure as part of who we are as book people, as Sherlockians, as Woodhousians. We cherish that community, and I wanted that to be part of the book. I thought it was essential to how it would read to people.
And you know, I just want to throw this in here. You know, the book is available now. It's actually the official publishing date is tomorrow, I think. But the truth is, Elliot and I really have been unable to say often enough or articulately enough how dramatically this book changed as a result of Ashley editing it. Because we really were thinking in terms of just, you know, all of these pieces, which we thought would read well together, and introducing them, you know, one before, we thought that was clever. We didn't, as Ashley said, we didn't realize the importance of that narrative and the importance of friendship in the telling of this story. So her contributions were difficult to explain how important they were.
Well, Curtis, has anyone ever told you what a nerd you are?
Yes, actually, I have been told that once or twice, but I'm really not kidding. She made this book what it is, and we are hugely grateful for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to say it's almost I'm trying to think of a good analogy, but I'm just on the spot here and I can't. But it's like you're writing a story about a friendship between two people and so on, and one of them's married, and it's about, and then someone comes in and says, you know, this really isn't the story about the friends, it's a story about the marriage. And you go, what? the wife is just a minor character. No, no, no. The wife is a major character. Redo it. And it was just looking at it like a totally different way. And yeah. And she, you know, and it was funny. She talks about that email. I remember reading that email and just thinking to myself, oh, my God. I mean, it was just really like that. It was like, this is something completely different. But it actually started a little bit before, because when I first came up with the idea and I went to Curtis and I said, I want to do this and I want yours in there. And he was busy with the nerd book, so he just went, okay, go ahead. And I went and I wrote all the introductions to his, and they were all like a paragraph, maybe two paragraphs. And then I gave him kind of a thing that he could say about mine and so on. And then he did his first introduction. It was like two pages long. I thought, oh, my God, he's really getting into this. I got to go rewrite mine. And so that's what made the introductions more interesting than just saying this is when this was written and why it was written and when it was published. But then it was Ashley who looked at it and said, no, those aren't introductions at all. That's the story. It was great.
That was wonderful insight.
I honestly expected after that email to get a response that was more or less, we really just wanted you to tell us where there were comma splices. If you could do that, that would be super. Everything else, please, please go jump in the sea. I just was astonished at the response I got back, which was excited. As an editor, you don't usually get authors who are that willing to kind of throw everything up in the air and give up what they'd already decided something ought to look like and be open to change. So it was a wonderful experience for me as an editor. I'm used to people telling me, no, what I wrote is already perfect. I don't understand.
Well, this let's talk a little bit about the book. This is it's quite a span. So what's in the book, for those of our listeners who are curious, which I hope are all of you, are sort of 10 major essays, papers, contributions to Woodhouse scholarship, Woodhouse perspective, Woodhouse anecdote, created over a period of what looks like 20 years, each with a substantive introduction. And so as we've discussed, you have the sort of parallel story of Curtis and Elliot's connection, but you also have sort of a distillation of the best of Woodhouse and or wonderful aspects of Woodhouse in different ways. And one of the great appeals of Woodhouse is to anybody who loves writing and storytelling. There is so much in the plotting, in his use of words. And one of Elliot's great pieces in here towards the front of, in fact, it's the very first major piece in the book, is Elliot's study of the openings of the novels of P.G. Woodhouse. And the best part, beyond that paper, is that the openings are actually in the appendix. And I remember years ago when this was reprinted after the 2015, it was reprinted after the Seattle Convention or something like that. And I think, Elliot, you had a PDF of it, and people could send you an email. And so I think I sent you an email and got a list of all of these things. But this is really wonderful for anyone who is a devotee of storytelling and how to set a scene and wonders about how to start things on the action. Can you talk, Elliot, a little bit about this collection and what you gathered from it and your insights about how Woodhouse got people into stories?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say that it's very interesting that you picked that and talked about how well it started off the book, because in the original structure of the book, it did not come first, and that's part of the genius of Ashley, is that she said, this has got to be the first article, and she was absolutely right for exactly the reasons that you gave. Woodhouse, I mean, there are certain writers that are very fine writers and great writers, but, you know, and I'll just use as an example Henry James, who I think is a great writer and I love, but you would never remember the opening line to a Henry James novel. It just wasn't something that he thought about in terms of how to structure a novel, what you know, how to get somebody into the book. They're going to get into it because I'm Henry James and you're going to read my book. But Woodhouse was all about grabbing that reader right away and trying to get them in. And that's why looking at his opening lines and openings of books was of interest. And becomes apparent to anybody who reads the book, the first thing that was ever written, which is at the end of the book, was my thesis that I did in 1976 in Toronto. And it was basically looking at the works of Woodhouse, or the novels specifically, and over a period of time, and seeing how he changed his approach, and that there are, in fact, three periods that you can categorize. And the openings, you can see in the early books how he's searching. He's trying to figure out a good way to get somebody into the story and grab their attention right away. And then by Leave It to Smith, which is the beginning of the middle period, he's got it. And it's by creating something that is really well-constructed sentence, that has a nice rhythm to it, that has a good sound to it, and is funny. And you just see that for the rest of the of his career.
Well, you do. And in your essay, and of course you can find it, you know, later on in this great index, you got some wonderful examples. And I was tickled when I read the book to find one of my absolute favorites in your essay, which is the opening of Heavy Weather, where Woodhouse wrote, "Sunshine pierced the haze that enveloped London. It came down Fleet Street, turned to the right, stopped at the premises of the Mammoth Publishing Company, and entering through an upper window, beamed pleasantly upon Lord Tilbury, founder and proprietor of that vast factory of popular literature, as he sat reading the batch of weekly papers which his secretary had placed on the desk for his inspection."
Genius.
Now, I would write that and put my pen down and wait for my Nobel Prize. Isn't that wonderful? You know, and you point out that he does that from time to time. You know, the morning sun becomes a character, and off you go. In a way, it's Hitchcockian. You know, Hitchcock would open up his films sometimes with these great crane shots that would take you from a far distance down through a window and into an intimate scene, right up to somebody's tie pin, you know, if he could figure out how to do it.
Well, one of the things also Eliot points out, I think, I forget which one it's in now, but you discuss the opening of Luck of the Bodkins being basically a reverse of that, right, El?
Yeah, it's a reverse zoom. It starts with an intense close-up, and then as you read the sentence, you can see the camera pulling out until it goes like from the tight close-up of the face to the coastline of France.
His ability to do that is really extraordinary. I mean, they're not all, you know, that cinematic. But that idea of, he does the same thing in Full Moon later on with the moon, a similar situation where the moon becomes a character. And it's shining over Blanding's castle and, you know, peeping in at the different windows and, you know, is the way of introducing the characters who are already at the castle. It's just remarkably inventive writing, and always, especially once he found his voice, consistently funny. Really pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we could spend we want to talk more about the book, and particularly about intersections between Holmes and Woodhouse, because there are sort of two big ones. But I have to, I can always cut this out in the editing, but I have to just find one of my favorites here. It's Jeeves and the Feudal Spirit. Remember, now we're talking about the opening into a book here. And the opening line is, "As I sat in the bathtub, soaping a meditative foot and singing, if I remember correctly, Pale Hands I Loved beside the Shalimar, it would be deceiving my public to say that I was feeling boomps-a-daisy."
And there's no other word to describe it.
This is this. He's such a writer. You know, you start laughing in the first sentence and you never stop. It's
you can't be in a crabby mood and reading Woodhouse at the same time. They are they are incompatible.
Yeah, yep, that's why I always have a little anthology of Woodhouse on my night table. It's a good thing to read. You know, if you've had a less than satisfactory day, it's a good thing to read before you you totter off. Should we talk just a little bit about the big intersections between Holmes and Woodhouse?
Yeah,
and
then we absolutely.
Before we do that, yeah, this is one for our editors. Going to do two things.
Oh, you want to drop in something?
Yeah. Two things. So while we're talking about first lines, favorite first lines. We're going to get back to this at the end of the show, kind of bookending it, as it were. So I want each of you to think about your favorite first lines of Woodhouse, and we have this handy appendix in a Plum assignment for reference. So be thinking about that. We'll pick it out, and we'll come back to you at the end of the show. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some of the intersections of Sherlock Holmes and P.G. Woodhouse. Forrest Gump famously said that life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And in many ways, the Baker Street Journal is like a box of chocolates because every quarter, you never know what you're going to get. And in some cases, you never know when you're going to get it. But when you crack open the pages of a Baker Street Journal, well, certainly you'll see the regular features there, like the editor's gas lamp, like artwork cartoons from Scott Bond, like the editor's commonplace book. Perhaps, sadly, you'll have to stand with us there on the terrace for some fallen Baker Street irregulars. But the rest of it is at the whim of the editor, Stephen Rothman, who has exquisite taste. He's been at this editing job at the Baker Street Journal for over 2 decades. And every issue, he puts together some of the best scholarship from some of the most insightful articles from Sherlockian scholars across the globe. So get on over to BakerStreetJournal.com. Take a look around there at some of the sample articles and the table of contents, and see what it is that you might get with a regular subscription to the Baker Street Journal. Try it today.
All right. Well, you know, we could just keep dipping in and out of it's a great temptation just to have sort of a 90-minute program. All you do is just dip in and out of Woodhouse. But let's talk for a little bit about the big intersections of between Holmes and Woodhouse. There are really sort of two of them. You know, one is that Woodhouse, I mean, my memory is that he left his job as a clerk in a bank around 1902 and then began writing articles. And in like the first year, I think the second year after he did that, around 1902, 1903, he interviewed Conan Doyle. And that was published in a magazine, I think, called Victoria Cross. Sort of a talk with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And Woodhouse begins he was clearly a fan. And we know that, that later on he became a friend of Conan Doyle and played in Conan Doyle's cricket team. But he opened up his, there are two interesting things I think about that article that was in Victoria Cross. One is the opening of it, and one is the end of the article. And he says, he opens by saying, one of the reasons why Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's books make such delightful reading is the vividness and truth of the outdoor episodes thereof. And the reason of the vividness is that he's had personal experience of the thing of which he writes. And there can be no doubt that however much such a feeling may be censured by the superior person, the public likes a man to resemble his books. It's grateful when a writer who can describe a fight like those in Rodney Stone and the Croxley Massacre is able to use the gloves in fact as well as in fiction. And then he goes on to describe Conan Doyle immensely powerful in build and the keenest of sportsmen. So I thought that, you know, that's a good sort of departure point to what's your thinking about the public liking a man to resemble his books. Do you two think that Woodhouse resembled his books and how? Or not?
Well, I don't think he did at all. I mean, I think it's sort of ironic that he would write that about Doyle, given the fact that, of course, you know, it's still relatively early in his career. He would wind up, you know, everyone just assumed that Woodhouse would be, you know, hysterically funny and brilliantly witty and, you know, the life of the party and all that. And the truth was he was very quiet, very reserved. I don't know if he resembled any character at all. It might have been Emsworth. I mean, you know, as sort of a doddering old, you know, character puttering around his garden and that kind of thing. He was channeling something, but I don't think it had anything to do with him in a way. What do you think, Al?
No, I agree. I was just going to say there are two things. There's the story, and I think it's in David Jason's biography, but he was on a liner going from England to America or back, and they discovered that he was on it and so on, and they had this night where they're going to have people on the ship perform, and they asked him if he would read something from one of his books. And, you know, he didn't want to, but he couldn't say no, and he got up there. And supposedly he started reading from a book that he was working on and began making changes and revisions and talking, and he just was mumbling to himself. And people began to just quietly leave. But I also remember seeing an interview that he did in television, there, and he was sitting outside. It was evidently rather cold. He had an overcoat on. The interviewer was talking. This is maybe in the late 60s or early 70s, very old. And every question the interviewer asked, he responded by saying, "Difficult to say. I suppose so." And it was just it's sad. I mean, it was just, but that you're absolutely right. I mean, he just saved it all for his writing, and you know, and in over 70, he talks about it and how difficult it would be to write his biography because it would be basically, you know, he said that there was a fellow who won an egg eating contest, and they interviewed him afterwards and said, "How did you do it?" And he said, "Well, first I ate an egg, and then I ate another one, and then I ate another one, and then I ate another one." He said, "Well, that's, you know, that's my biography. I wrote a book, and then I wrote another one, and then I wrote another one."
Yeah, but you know, when it comes to Doyle, it's interesting to me too because Woodhouse made constant references throughout his writing life to Sherlock Holmes and Watson. They're all through his books from all three periods, I think.
All right, from the very first book.
Yes.
Right. And so he was always, I mean, the early books were school books, schoolboys, you know, in that sort of Edwardian period where they would have been, they all would have been reading Sherlock Holmes at the time. But what's interesting is how later in his life, Doyle then became the public's idea in a way because he did become involved with a couple of real life crimes. It didn't seem like he became involved with them because of almost the social being that he was. He was approached. Someone was saying there is a wrong here that needs righting, which was much more the knight in him than it was the private consulting detective in him. And he did become involved in them, and he did make deductions which you know, helped guide people to the truth, or what was perceived to be the truth. So he was sort of like Sherlock Holmes in a way, but I don't think he was as a person at all like Sherlock Holmes.
But in character, don't you think he's much more Watsonian? I mean, that knight errant personality.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I think that's exactly who he was. Yeah. And there's a picture, a famous picture of him that was taken with William Gillette, who was the American actor, obviously, who played Sherlock Holmes to great acclaim, the first real Sherlock Holmes, flesh-and-blood Sherlock Holmes. And the two of them had a picture taken together, and it's, you know, it's Doyle and Gillette, but for all purposes, it's really Holmes and Watson standing there.
Mm. Well, and it's true. And in the end of that interview, you know, Woodhouse closes that interview with quoting Conan Doyle on his views of the English race, you know, whether or not the race of Englishmen had been going down from its great past. And Conan Doyle says, oh, not a bit of it, and has this anecdote about ordinary people from Lancashire who, with whom he served in South Africa in the hospitals, who, even though they had enteric fever, were soldiering on and giving a terrific day's work. And, you know, you get that sort of continued echo of Conan Doyle's, what had been satirized or has been satirized is sort of the archetypal Englishman, you know, the
right
defender of the empire.
But here's another thing, though. With Conan Doyle never stopped experiencing. He never stopped traveling. Mm. He was, you know, serving in South Africa, for example, or you know, on whalers, or touring the world in support of spiritualism, whatever it was that he was doing, whether it was really, you know, his sporting life. All of these things never stopped with him, and until he reached a point where he had to just die. He could not stop experiencing things. And Woodhouse never returned to England after World War II. He was still writing about England constantly, but it was an England of his own imagination. Mm. And he, aside from being a keen sportsman, meaning he played cricket and football and that sort of thing, you know, as a young man, he was somebody who very much preferred sitting quietly and smoking a pipe and writing. It was all in his imagination. And Doyle was able to write all of these boxing stories and, you know, adventure stories, doctor stories, detective stories, horror stories based in a lot of cases on his own experiences as an active, you know, vivid man who was still traveling the world, you know, until shortly before his death.
Well, and fat lot of good that did him. He died at the age of 70. Woodhouse lived to 93.
Yeah, well, that's
which
true.
Just goes
maybe
to
that,
joke.
There's something to be said for that.
Sit at home, smoke your pipe, read your
book.
Write your book.
Don't go anywhere.
Yeah. And then we have to get back to the book, but I can't resist just touching on the second big intersection between Woodhouse and Conan Doyle, which of course is from a detective's notebook, which is also known, it's a short story also known as Adrian Mulliner's Greatest Triumph. And for our listeners who don't know about Mr. Mulliner, lucky you, because these are stories narrated by a Mr. Mulliner all about one different nephews that he has. In some case, the same nephew, the same name appears, but is a completely different person. But this is a story that Woodhouse wrote, I think, to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Conan Doyle in 1959. It was in Punch, and it begins as Adrian, you know, you're just in the story. It begins, we were sitting around the club fire, old General Malpas, Driscoll the QC, young Freddie Finch, Finch and myself, when Adrian Mulliner, the private investigator, gave a soft chuckle. This was, of course, in the smoking room where soft chuckling is permitted. I wonder, he said, if it would interest you chaps to hear the story of what I always look upon as the greatest triumph of my career. We said, no, it wouldn't, and he began. And then he goes on to say, well, looking back over my years as a detective, I recall many problems. But through all, I can think none of them, none of my feats of ratiocination, which gave me more pleasure than the unmasking of the man Sherlock Holmes, now better known as the Fiend of Baker Street. And he goes on in the story, you know, we won't give you, you can tell that Adrian believes he has the key to the dark truth of Sherlock Holmes, and we'll leave you to discover that yourself.
Yeah.
But Woodhouse was a great fan of Holmes and frequently quotes the canon and Holmesian observations in his works.
Well, I remember being struck by one of the books, early book actually, was Indiscretions of Archie. And that has a story which is basically borrows heavily and in fact quotes considerable sections from the adventure of the Speckled Band, in an otherwise, you know, pure comedic thing that takes place in New York. So he did constantly do that. He also wrote a very nice introduction to a paperback edition of Sign of the Four that appeared in the 70s. It was a box set, and they had different famous people, Graham Greene and that sort, writing introductions. And Woodhouse wrote the one for Sign of the Four. And, you know, it's clear, I don't have it to hand to quote, but it's clear from it the depth of appreciation that he had for Doyle. I mean, there were a lot of people who, you know, he could get irritable about, like H.G. Wells, his work, his later work. He never had anything bad to say about Doyle's later work, even when other people were sniping at it, the later Sherlock Holmes stories, not being up to snuff necessarily. He never did that. He was a, as you say, a devoted admirer of Doyle's work.
Well, I have my copy of that right here. That
well, there you are. We're talking to the right people.
The right people of that introduction. He says about Conan Doyle, "We were great friends in those days. Our friendship interrupted only when I went to live in America." He could have played cricket for any first-class county. He used to have cricket weeks at his place in the country, to which I was nearly always invited. And after a day's cricket and a big dinner, he and I would discuss literature. And Woodhouse says, "The odd thing was that though he could be expansive about his least known short stories, I could never get him to talk about Sherlock Holmes." Mm. And then in the rest of the introduction, he goes on to speculate very Baker Street journally in about Holmes's finances. And brings in Violet Hunter. It's a wonderful little introduction. And he closes by saying, just, you know, he's got sort of a funny remark about Watson, but then he closes by saying, "Like all the rest of you, I am never happier than when curled up with Sherlock Holmes. And I hope that Messrs. Ballantyne, who published this paperback, will sell several million of him. As the fellow said, there's no police like Holmes."
Yep.
Well, as we know, as Sherlockians, we mentioned this in past shows, but it's worth revisiting. There is an overlap between aficionados of both P.G. Woodhouse and Sherlock Holmes, where they meet every year for a junior bloodstain and every other year for a senior bloodstain. Who'd like to tell us about these gatherings?
Del, do you want to cover that?
No, the Sherlock Holmes I leave entirely up to you.
Well, yeah, but Holmes is the junior
right,
bloodstain, but the senior bloodstain is the Woodhouse Society.
It's the Woodhouse Society, and it goes by two names. It's the senior bloodstain and also the clients of Adrian Mulliner.
Yes.
And at the Woodhouse Society meetings, they always have a group. We find a room for them somewhere, and they do readings and skits and things. I was actually very, very proud of the first convention that I was ever in charge of, which my wife actually organized, but I was in charge of it. And it was in Toronto, and we held the senior bloodstain meeting in the Sherlock Holmes room in the Toronto Public Library.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, very, very happy that I was able to arrange that for those people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we do have a large group of Sherlockians who gather for the Baker Street Irregulars birthday weekend, which is actually becoming kind of a week, and I'm not complaining. But we gathered, and there is always a room in the on the Saturday morning where the or afternoon where the clients of Adrian Mulliner meet. There's usually an original one-act play which is presented. It's a delightful way for Woodhouseians who are there to celebrate Sherlock Holmes to do both at once.
Absolutely.
And Sherlockians who are at the Woodhouse Society meeting
exactly
to do the same. Yeah.
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 So what's one of your most memorable events or occasions at a Woodhouse Society meeting?
Well, Elliot has done much more of that than I. Why doesn't he tell you, and I'll think about what mine is?
I think, I mean, if, right off the top of my head, watching Curtis play cricket.
That wasn't what I thought you were going to say.
I'm so sorry, I missed that.
Yeah,
you know, oh, that was something.
I don't even need to see it to enjoy it. I get it.
I had never been to a Woodhouse convention before. This was my first. And I was there once I had committed to it, and I was delivering a paper as well. So it was a big deal for me. And I was very excited, and I just wanted to experience everything. And it was one of those things where somebody said to me, well, you're coming to the cricket match, aren't you? And I said, oh, sure, I'll watch some cricket. No, you have to play. You have to play cricket. And I used to play, you know, little sort of pickup games of cricket when I lived in Switzerland with my English friends. And I'd been 11. And I haven't gotten any better. So I went, and by God, I played cricket with the best of them. I didn't play as well as the best of them, but I was out there. I did it.
Do you know cricket is responsible for my only interaction with the larger Woodhouse community? Living in England, working on my PhD, I decided that I would attend the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, PG Woodhouse Society UK cricket match. And I had friends who were not all that far from High Wycombe, and we were all going to converge and bring our picnic and set out and watch the cricket match. And I searched and searched for all my ingredients. I made myself a strawberry rhubarb pie, which is not an easy thing to search for at the time of year in England, and carried it all the way on the train. And the match was canceled due to rain. So we all sat in the rain with our picnic on the side of a hill in High Wycombe and made up our own cricket match. And it was really all for the best, because even up until the point where I arrived, I was afraid I was going to experience some kind of existential crisis over which team I was going to root for. So it was all for the best. It was all for the best in the end.
Well, you know, it's remarkable because every year I've never been to that match, but it seems like every year I do read that it has been canceled on account of rain.
I was just going to say, I think that's the rule rather than the exception.
Yeah, I think that's
well.
True.
The pie was excellent, so
that I believe
it's all that matters in the end.
So, if one of our listeners was thinking about just getting into Woodhouse, I think there's a is it the grace that we say at Speckled Band for the children who are yet unborn? How lucky they are! If someone has yet to read Woodhouse, where would you start them out?
Well, I actually worked in a bookstore in Toronto right after I graduated from university for a couple of years. And when I became manager of the bookstore, I vastly expanded the Woodhouse section and personally sold hundreds of copies of Woodhouse. One of my friends described me as the Johnny Appleseed of Woodhouse books. But I tended, because I started with Service with a Smile, I tended to do that one first with most people. But usually what I like to do is to get into a conversation with them and find out what they've been reading and what they would be, you know, what they enjoy and that kind of thing. And it's either write Ho Jeeves or Service with a Smile, or very occasionally, if there's a specific something that they're interested in and the conversation goes a certain way, I'll pick a non-saga book. Actually, my son's fiance was sucking up to me just the other day and asked for a Woodhouse. And I...
And, smart one, that.
After our conversation, I actually decided to give her Hot Water, which she enjoyed immensely, and is now reading her third Woodhouse. And I just got a text from her today. She just started Heavy Weather, and she texted me, I don't have my phone or I'd read it, but this may very well be the greatest book I've ever read. So
she's really laying it on thick.
Well, no, the thing is the wedding is absolutely guaranteed. She doesn't need to do this. So it's clearly the family fortune
she's looking after.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
I don't know. It's interesting. I actually did this recently. I was selling books at one of our local bookstores here, Vroman's. I had done an event there to publicize my book, not this book, but the Revenge of the Nerd book. And they invited authors who had done events at their bookstore to spend one Saturday selling books on the floor, you know, wearing the apron and the whole deal.
I saw that.
Yeah, and I did.
Yeah.
I did, and it was it was so wonderful. I've never had such a good time, and I did sell a Woodhouse book during the course of the day, and it was Right Ho Jeeves, and I've gone back and forth over the year. I've never considered starting someone on a Blandings. For some reason, maybe it's because I started on Woodhouse, on Worcester, I don't know. But I have never really been tempted to do that. I always tend to go with Jeeves and Worcester because the laugh quotient to the books, he says something about in one of his letters, I think, he talks about how important it is with the Jeeves Worcester books that you get a laugh almost on every paragraph. So for young readers especially, I tend to go for that. I probably would go with Summer Lightning if I was going to recommend a Blandings book for a first one.
And how about you, Ashley?
I have a completely different method because I've never worked in a bookstore, but I am an English teacher, which is if I see a Woodhouse book, regardless of what it is, at a used bookstore for, you know, a dollar or something, I just grab it. And I actually have a little bucket outside my office door with a sign that says, free, take one. These are my favorite books. And any student who goes by my office is welcome to just grab them. So it could be anything, as long as they take a book, as long as it makes them read.
Good Lord, Ashley, what if it was if I were you?
Well, you can't win them all. You just can't win them all.
Yeah, yeah. No, the introduction to Woodhouse is a little more challenging now, I think, even than it was in the 60s. Unlike Sherlock Holmes, Holmes has, you know, it's always been Holmes and Watson. And even when, you know, Universal was doing those movies or when you know, there were movies done in, like, Study in Terror or, you know, the non-canonical films that have been done over the years, or the Gillette play, things like that. it's always basically been Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson solving crimes. It's really easy, you know. Whatever form they take in the adaptation, it's pretty easy for people to grab it. They either like it or they don't. With Woodhouse, there's so many options, and they really are different. And it's a little bit more of a challenge, also given the fact that it is a world which is not as instantly relatable to young readers. If they don't get the language, it's a little harder for them to grasp it, I think.
Well, you know, that's a good point, Curtis, because, you know, we know that Woodhouse spent upwards of a year or even more sometimes working on his plots. And yet we don't necessarily read Woodhouse for his plots. We read it for the style and language and the humor that he brought, almost like a musical comedy kind of action, right?
Right.
And it strikes me that over the course and my own personal experience with Woodhouse is rather limited at this point, but every time I've picked one up, I've found a turn of phrase that it just sticks with me. Like, he drank coffee with the air of a man who regretted it was not hemlock. And that kind of thing is universal, right? It doesn't necessarily take, you know, having been raised in the Edwardian or post-depression era, everyone can relate to that. So, yeah. What are some elements? I mean, do you have a favorite simile or some elements that you think are universal that even kids today can grasp?
I often say, if I'm describing someone, that's a person who looks like they've been poured into their clothes. I forgot to say when.
Yes.
Or sat down in an armchair in a way that suggested that armchairs were being worn tight around the hips that season. I love the descriptions so much. But I would say arguably that's one of the reasons that Woodhouse doesn't have the kind of cultural saturation that Sherlock Holmes does, because the language is very difficult to adapt. So much of it rests in the description. The reason I think that Jeeves and Wooster gets adapted more than some of the other stories perhaps do is because of that first person narrative voice. You can grab some of that and put it into the mouth of Bertie or some of the other, you know, his friends and so forth. But so much of it is in the descriptions, where those turns of phrases are so clever. They're so perfect. They're architecturally perfect. And once you just sort of let a camera roam across a country estate, it doesn't have the same appeal as the language where you have personified sunshine. I mean, it's just, it doesn't translate to screen as well. And so I think that might be one of the reasons why Woodhouse hasn't endured for as large a swath of the population as Sherlock Holmes has.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true. You know, the beauty about Jeeves and Wooster, particularly, you know, if you're bringing them to the screen or the radio or to the stage, is that they're well-defined characters. You know, they have behaviors and profiles and things like that. And there's little inconsistent characterization in the rest of Woodhouse. You know,
I think you have it in the Blanding stories, I think.
Yes, you do.
I mean, Emsworth is a very, very specifically drawn character.
Yes, that's true. But even when they took all the other stories, you know, years ago they did that series Woodhouse Playhouse.
Yes,
with,
right.
John Alderton and Pauline Collins.
Right.
And those were fun, but, you know, it was just not Jeeves and Wooster for some reason.
No, they were Mulliner stories and golf stories and a couple of drone stories. You know, they didn't have recurring characters to latch on to. It was really a thing for Pauline Collins and John Alderton, who'd been, you know, so famous off of Upstairs Downstairs.
Right.
And it was something for them to do as talents, and less concern was given to how the Woodhouse stories were actually adapted.
Mm.
I think the other thing is that, and again, I don't want to talk about Sherlock Holmes to people that know so much more than I do, but when I think of Holmes and Watson, to me, they're almost real people. I mean, whether you're looking
almost at
movies or whatever, okay, and there are people who actually keep her away from great works of art. But I mean, really, they're so real, and Woodhouse didn't create real people. His characters are characters. They're in many ways caricatures. And so it doesn't really translate. It really is all about the language. I think what really made Woodhouse a genius in a way is not just that he was a genius with language, but he knew that even though it was about the language, he needed to have good plots. Because without the plots, you may laugh a little bit at the beginning, but you're going to get bored with the story. And he really worked hard on crafting his plots, and that's what makes the stories endure. Because without that, you really just have a joke book.
I think that's very true. You know, there's, you know, without getting too artsy about it all, you know, there's a lovely moment, you know, if you listen to a Beethoven piano sonata or a great work of music where a theme comes and it's expanded and travels throughout the orchestra and has infinite variations. And then it just sort of fades for a moment. And then there's some measures of silence and you say to yourself, boy, I wonder how the composer is going to wrap this up because everything seems to have stopped. And then there's this inevitable closure that's so satisfying. It's the same thing in Woodhouse, you know, and you see it in a story that Scott mentioned, Uncle Fred Flits By, where one thing leads to another, and there's this sudden event. People come upon the scene, and there's another reaction, and you wonder, my goodness, what's going to happen next? Or, you know, or poor Bertie winds up, you know, naked in a rainstorm on a bicycle in the middle of the night going somewhere. And you just say to yourself, how will we ever get out of this? And Woodhouse, the old master, you know, just tugs on the thread, and it's just inevitable. It's like dominoes falling, and it's so satisfying.
Mm. Yeah,
that's the beauty of farce.
Yeah,
farce has to be perfectly plotted. You know, and if you watch a farce on stage, it's all people missing each other by seconds, going in and out of doors. And if you're acting in a farce, you have to have that amount of precision. And if you are writing a farce, you have to have that equal amount of precision with the plotting, I think.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's well said, yeah.
Good point. Well, we threatened to return to this earlier in the show, and by God, here we are. Toward the end, we want to cover appendix. I was going to say appendix A. It's just the appendix. And lest any of your copies have an appendectomy, we ask you to turn to page 169. There's a list of all of the openings to the novels of P.G. Woodhouse. And we'd like to hear from each of our guests here as to their favorite opening. So why don't we reverse order here and start with Curtis?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to obviously there's a huge amount to choose from, and it's sort of any day could be different. I'm going to start with the beginning paragraph of the opening of the very first Woodhouse story that I read ever, which was Jeeves and the Impending Doom. And it's another one of those things where when you read it, when it's in front of you in print, you can, you know, dazzle at how glorious it is. But it was what hooked me for life. It was the morning of the day on which I was slated to pop down to my Aunt Agatha's place at Woolham Chersey in the county of Herts for a visit of 3 solid weeks. And as I seated myself at the breakfast table, I don't mind confessing that the heart was singularly heavy. We Worcesters are men of iron, but beneath my intrepid exterior at that moment, there lurked a nameless dread. That was it for me.
That would do it. That would do it. Okay, Elliot, you're up.
Well, in my talk on openings, I mentioned my favorite one, and I give it in there, and I'll do it here, which is Joy in the Morning. You would think it would be a Blandings. Actually, Full Moon is a close second for me, and they come one right after the other. But I think that this opening sentence to Joy in the Morning is really one of the finest, finely crafted sentences in the English language. It goes, after the thing was over, when peril had ceased to loom and happy endings had been distributed in heaping handfuls, and we were driving home with our hats on the side of our heads, having shaken the dust of Steeple Bumpley from our tires, I confessed to Jeeves that there had been moments when Bertram Wooster, though no weakling, had come very near to despair.
That's great.
In my talk, I dissect that sentence, but I just think it has a nice sound to it. It's a great way to get you into the story, but it's just so well written. It begins in verse. I mean, after the thing was over, when peril had ceased to loom, it's just a great sentence.
Yeah. Okay, Ashley, we'll wrap it up with you.
Sure. The thing that I tend to like the most in Woodhouse's prose is when he takes a word and he uses it as the wrong part of speech. He does it so adeptly that as somebody who teaches grammar, it always appeals to me. So I'm going to have to say stiff upper lip, Jeeves. Which goes like this. I marmalated a slice of toast with something of a flourish, and I don't suppose I've ever come much closer to saying tra-la-la as I did the lathering, for I was feeling in mid-season form this morning. The use of marmalated a slice of toast as a verb is genius.
I think it's also interesting that all three of us, who have a lot of Woodhouse under our belt, have all picked Jeeves Wooster story openings for our favorites.
Well, just goes to show you there's a little something for everyone in Woodhouse.
Yep.
Over the course of 74 years that he wrote, 72 years that he wrote, I guess. An incredible opus. So the book is A Plum Assignment, Discourses on P.G. Woodhouse and His World. You can get it at local bookstores, Amazon. We'll have a link to buy it here in the show notes. Again, the show, you can find it at ihose.co/ihose143, all lowercase. And I'm sure Curtis and Elliot and Ashley would love to hear from you when you buy the book. They will be out there and about, I'm sure, and would love to hear your feedback. Gents, lady, thank you very much for being with us. Well, that was a lot of fun, you know. Anytime we get more than two people on the line, I get a little skittish about how this is going to work out. And with a raucous topic like P.G. Woodhouse, you never know how things are going to go. But I dare say everyone was fairly well behaved. And I'm delighted that this book is out. I enjoyed it immensely. Not only the interview, but the book itself. Because P.G. Woodhouse is one of those things that I burned hot on it for a short period of time, and I never really went back to it. And now I feel as if I have the impetus. I feel like I have the motivation and the camaraderie. And certainly if Elliot is threatening me with local meetings, then boy, I better get up to speed on this stuff.
Well, it's a lot of fun, you know, and you were very right to reference the speckled band Grace, you know, which points to future generations, how we envy them.
Yes.
Who will encounter these works, because Woodhouse, Well, you know, that's the challenge when you get a group of people together to talk about a writer or a body of work, you know, to do it in a way that, that doesn't seem to be just one admiration after another and a bit distant from the audience. But Woodhouse's work is so entertaining, so funny, so interesting, so reliable. And for particularly for people who are interested in storytelling and in plotting, and if you write, if you are yourself a writer and you have a sense of structure. Years ago, I discovered a biography of Woodhouse, and that led me to books about Woodhouse and other biographies. And at this point, I've read his collected letters, a series of biographies. The fascinating thing about him from the standpoint of people who love writing is that, as we said in the discussion with Curtis and Elliot and Ashley, he literally spent his life writing. He was happy sitting at a typewriter and unhappy when he wasn't sitting at a typewriter. And this is somebody who, before he began a novel, would type 400 single-spaced pages with narrow margins all about the plot. And when you read these things, and some of these things are reprinted in these biographies, it's a running conversation with himself. It says, so in this story, Bertie needs to come to the castle. But what day of the week? I think it should probably be. He comes and he finds this situation going. And, you know, this apparently was his life. And it's one of the reasons why the stories are, you know, so well worked out and so... so funny. They were just polished. It seems as if they were just sort of polished endlessly.
Yeah. Jeeves lugged my purple socks out of the drawer as if he were a vegetarian fishing a caterpillar out of his salad.
There are so many of those lovely phrases here, and I can never find, you know, the ones that I like. There's one, it doesn't pay to really describe it, but it's, but for example, Uncle Fred in the Springtime, there's a line, a full-throated baying, a cross between a bloodhound on the trail and a Scotsman celebrating New Year's Eve. He had a wintry contortion of his facial muscles, which might have passed in a dim light for a smile.
Or sometimes it's just as simple as Bingo swayed like a jelly in a high wind.
Oh, how about this? Quick service, 1940. He was white and shaken like a sidecar cocktail.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, we could go on like this for episodes.
Let's do it. Oh, let's not.
Well, maybe that's a side podcast, just, you know, Woodhouse One-Liners.
Oh, I like that, woodhouseoneliners.com. Yeah. She unshipped, from Wright Ho Jeeves, 1934, she unshipped a sigh that sounded like the wind going out of a rubber duck.
Oh.
But you notice the structure. I mean, even there in these lines that we like to repeat because they have such impact and they're so funny, the gag is at the end. You know, you start the sentence and it seems perfectly reasonable. You know, she unshipped a sigh, but it's a curious word, unshipped, that sounded like the wind going out, and then you end with a rubber duck. You know, it's just everything is so beautifully put together.
Yeah, it really is. My Aunt Agatha, for instance, is tall and thin and looks rather like a vulture in the Gobi Desert, while Aunt Dahlia is short and solid, like a scrum half in the game of rugby football. In disposition, too, they differ widely. Aunt Agatha is cold and haughty, though presumably unbending a bit when conducting human sacrifices at the time of the full moon, as she is widely rumored to do, and her attitude towards me has always been that of an austere governess, causing me to feel as if I were 6 years old and she had just caught me stealing jam from the jam cupboard. Whereas Aunt Dahlia is as jovial and bonhomous as a dame in a Christmas pantomime. Oh, the Worcester aunts.
The Worcester aunts. Oh, you know, there is, and the interesting thing too about, Woodhouse in these areas is that there was such variety in them.
Mm.
For example, there's a whole list of insults. She has about, oh no, that's not a very good one. Oh, you'll like this, an accordion or a stomach Steinway. I've never heard an accordion referred to as a stomach Steinway before.
That's a good one.
Yeah, she gave me the sort of look she would have given a leper she wasn't fond of. The Duke's was the largest trouser seat in the peerage. Sir Roderick sort of just waggled an eyebrow in my direction, and I saw that it was back to the basket for Bertram. I never met a man who had such a knack for making a fellow feel like a waste product.
The usual drawback to success is that it annoys one's friends so. The favorite.
Mm.
Oh, well. I hadn't the heart to touch my breakfast. I told Jeeves to drink it himself. Well, on that note, we'll toddle off here. And, you know, it's always delightful when we can welcome a third sponsor. And I think you folks will recognize this sponsor hasn't been with us in a while, but coming back for a rousing and raging return. Here we go.
Friends, if you're like me, you've always wanted to make the world of Sherlock Holmes part of your everyday life. And now you can with the Baker Street Sitting Room Collection from Sherlock Holmes Brand Products. It's everything you need to turn a spare room or closet into Victorian England. Choose an authentic gasogene. Weave your own basket chair. Enjoy a working chemical table. And so much more. All our furniture is carefully crafted of real wood, cunningly designed to fit together with just a few twists of our tiny Swedish wrenches. It's the only designer Victorian furniture system that delivers the three C's. Convincing, canonical, cupboards. And if you act today, you'll receive a special bonus recording of Victorian sound effect. All waiting for you at your local Sherlock Holmes brand retailer today.
And now, it's the time you've been waiting for. It's canonical couplet time. You may recall in the last episode, episode 142, we challenged you with, by this we're taught the all-important truth that brothers seldom share a single tooth. Do you know what story that was referring to, Bert?
Oh, of course, that was the case of the weaver's tooth.
Oh, clearly you're all trifled up right now. That was a fine reference to episode 69 on trifles there, all about occupations. By the way, folks, if you haven't started listening to Trifles yet, we highly recommend it. It's our weekly 15-minute long show where we talk about just some of the things we pick up in the canon. Check it out if you would. But no, that's not the tooth we were referring to in this case. The all-important truth that brothers seldom share a single tooth. Who was it that had a gold tooth in the canon? It was Harry and Arthur Pinner, who were the quote-unquote brothers in The Stockbroker's Clerk.
The Stockbroker's Clerk. Yes. Those Pinners.
Yes, Pinner brothers. Well, we are sad to say that no one answered that correctly. So...
Oh, dear. So that means the prize pot is doubled for this week.
Well, it means there are still more prizes left in the pot than before.
Okay, I'll have Victorian orthodonture for $200.
All right, hold still while I tighten this wire around your neck.
Oh, perfect.
Well, so this time, we decided that to broaden the opportunity. You know, we used to have the canonical couplet only available to folks that had been part of our regular donors, you know, Patreon and PayPal donors. And we thought, well, why restrict it? Why don't we open it up to all of our listeners? So we will do that instead. You don't have to give to us. We will gladly give a prize to whomever can answer this. And from all of the correct responses that are submitted, and there will be correct responses, plural. You hear me, folks? We will select one winner at random. Okay. So, this week's canonical couplet is... Poor lady, victim of a pious knave, was almost buried in a double grave. If you think you know the answer to this canonical couplet, as in, which story is that referring to, write it down in an email, send it to us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. That's comment@ihearofsherlock.com. Put canonical couplet in the subject of the email, and off you go. I think that just about wraps it up for episode 143. That must mean that the next episode is gross. 144. Oh, looking forward to it. Do you know who we're going to have on yet?
Oh, yeah, but I'm not at liberty to tell you. You know, the operations department won't let me inform you about this.
We need to speak to them about that. Well, I guess it's an incentive to just show up in a couple of weeks and see exactly who it is that we do interview.
Oh, yeah. You know, and the big problem is I keep getting these letters from Amelia Earhart, you know, that always says the same thing. Now? Can I come on the show now?
May she forever keep doing that.
Yeah.
Well, until that time, I remain one episode short of a gross, Scott Monty.
And I'm the grosser, Bert Wolder.
The game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
We'll save the boring, perfunctory parts for when Bert and I are alone. And we really—you
are nothing even close to being boring or perfunctory.
Boring. I remember that first Woodhouse novel in 1943. It had a glue binding because of the war. I remember that there were four sections instead of three because of the stitching. And, of course, that volume sold at Sotheby's for $550 million.
Okay.
Yeah. I had two copies and left one on the train. What a fool. I followed that train for weeks, I remember. It went north into England past Nottingham. No, I'm wrong. It was on the Jubilee line.
That's wonderful.
Care to take that back now?
I
listen to that all day.
You're talking about the version of Money in the Bank that was printed in Holland, right?
Yes, the Deutschmark. Yes, the one from the Rijksmuseum. I remember it well. Yes. Oddly enough, Van Gogh, you know, before he cut his ear off, put a bit of cerulean blue on one of Woodhouse's novels, and that was sold, I think, Heritage Auctions for $7 billion, bought by a Chinaman named Xing Lu, who apparently owns an integrated circuit factory in Shanghai. Oh, no, I'm wrong. It's not Shanghai at all.
Oh, God.
Well, this was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Let's do it again sometime.
Really?
Absolutely.